Ladies and gentlemen, I think we'd like to get started because the formal presentations offered a great deal of rich content that we'd like to explore. The way I propose to handle this is to have about a half hour of interchange among our panelists to allow them to respond to each other's remarks, and then we'll take the remaining time for questions from the floor. Since I'm probably not going to get a chance to say very much more until right at the end, I thought I'd just lead off with my own impressions, uninformed as they are, that in Canada at least, we're used to thinking of freedom of religion as a negative right, as an individual right, and as almost indistinguishable from freedom of conscience, such that it's not, it's the right to avoid interference with one's conscience. Therefore, it also contains a right of freedom from religion. I think that one of the things that becomes clear from our presenters' remarks is that not all religions share that same concept of freedom of religion, and that often freedom of religion is seen as an active thing. It is a freedom to practice religion, including elements of religion that are incompatible with the conscience of other individuals. And that dichotomy often informs the struggles of freedom of religion as a human right, as a civil right, as an individual right versus as a communal right. I've found a number of very interesting ways to think about that in our speaker's remarks, and I'm going to do it as a free-for-all in terms of people responding to each other. But I think what I will do is ask if any of our speakers has a comment on the remarks made by other speakers that they would like to initiate as an organizing principle for some of this discussion.
We do not.
Actually, partly, I mean, since this is for Professor, how do you pronounce your name? Tibaraki?
Tibarat.
You know, you gave a very detailed historical, overview of the experience of Europe. And for me, as a Tibetan Buddhist, now living in a modern society, I've always found the experience of Christianity in the Western European context a very interesting case example, as the Tibetan tradition, which is society, which is very deeply religious, moves more and more towards kind of greater exposure to modernity. So in this context, what I would like to ask you is that in my naive assessment of the outcome of the European experience is that somehow in the European context, the dominant religion, which is Christianity and to some extent Judaism, seems to have made peace with this kind of secularization process where there's a kind of a divide between the public and the private, and the faith is relegated to the private sphere, so that the public space is occupied primarily by secular, however you may want to define it. Many of the examples that were given about the challenges that are being faced in current European situation is partly kind of somehow now dealing with a new reality where there is another form of religion is coming in and which has not gone through this experience that Europe has gone through. So I was wondering maybe if you could elaborate on how, Christianity, which for a long time wasn't that kind of accommodating.
No.
how did it really get there,
Well, I suppose the thumbnail version of my talk was that you get to accommodation through struggle, not through consensus. I think it was a very difficult struggle where people of very different faiths who really abhorred one another, and the virulence of the rhetoric, you know, matches much of the virulent rhetoric that we've seen in recent centuries as well, or decades, or even years. But that through a political process which is inherently contentious, they worked out two kinds of accommodation. One is horizontal, being able to live with one another, with people who are different from yourself, in precisely the very ways that you were talking about, this inability to recognize that other person on the street in, let's say, France, to a position of being able to live side by side, because life without that was not feasible. In fact, it was far too violent, and it was unacceptable to anyone in the long run. The other part of it is, of course, the relationship to authority, both religious and political authority. And I think it's important for us to see rites as relational. They describe a relationship between authorities and subjects, citizens. And they are, I think, as my mentor and friend Charles Tilly said, they're enforceable claims that subjects and citizens can make on their rulers. And that is not the sum total of what religious freedom is all about, because for most people, religious freedom is the ability to worship collectively, corporatively, outside of the purview of the state. That limitation on the state's authority is in terms of privilege, whereas the individual's right to not be disturbed in one's faith, as that rhetoric that gradually developed in Europe put it, is an individual right. And there's always that tension. Now, if I had had more time today, I would have talked about how, after a long period of conflict, you don't get an idealized sort of peace. What you get is grudging consent to a reality, to a fact. As my, I'm forgetting your name. As Valerie said at the other end, pluralism is a fact of life. It's a description. It's something we live with. And pluralism came to be the fact of life in Europe, despite the fact that people didn't want that. And they finally gave their grudging consent to that. But it was never pretty, and it was rarely equal in the way that we theorize it in the 20th century or the 21st century. And so it's terribly messy. And one of the legacies of coming to grips with difference was the production and ultimately the reproduction over and over and over again of durable inequalities. Inequalities that might have started out as simply religious, but then became parallel to or reinforced by other kinds of inequalities, which would be access to education, access to welfare, access to certain kinds of occupations. In other words, economic, geographic, social inequality begins to map with religious inequality. And that's a durable inequality. And you can say at some point in a moment of great enlightenment, religion no longer matters. That religious difference doesn't count for us. But then you still have all those other inequalities that look a lot like racism, or the effects of racism, or sexism, or gender inequality. Those things are so complex and durable that they're hard to undo. And that's what essentially the newcomers to Europe today have to deal with. They come in with a package of durable inequalities. They come in with religious differences, but they also come in with linguistic and all of other differences that are packaged together. And one of the really striking and sad changes that I've noticed in Europe, the part of Europe that I know best is the Netherlands and Belgium, the Low Countries. What I've noticed is that immigrants to Europe who used to be identified by their place of origin, like Turks and Moroccans, have morphed into Muslims. And they are no longer allowed to be Turks and Moroccans. They're now Muslims. And that's the way they've been othered in the current discourse. And it's very sad that their diversity is no longer recognized and they're put into that very contentious basket.
Francis.
I think that, first of all, I found your answer, the question and answer very interesting. And I wonder whether it wasn't partly the development of Protestantism that allowed the accommodation. Because, as you pointed out, the concept of individual choice really was, it seems to me, I hesitate to say it, not being in any way the expert on Christianity, and so this is posed as a question, but it seems to me that development did allow a more de-hierarchized approach to state and religion, which again allowed a horizontal coexistence. It's interesting because in Judaism, in Israel, there are demands that the state be Jewish, have Jewish law. The ultra-Orthodox want the very ultra-Orthodox refuse to recognize the state because it's not a perfectly Jewish law state. But Judaism in Europe had a principle, Dina de Malchuta Dina, the king's law is the law. So what I'm trying to say is I think it's not just the existence of pluralism, but it is the relation of the particular religion to the power structure of the state. Christianity started off being extremely pacifist and tolerant, did it not? It became aggressive and crusading when it integrated with political power from Constantine and onwards. So it seems to me a really complex thing in which it's the nature of the religion, it's of one particular religion, its ability to accommodate, and its relationship to the power system of the state.
I would only respond by saying that I think it's one of those bad habits we have about European history to give the credit to Protestantism, because I think the language of choice is the language of dissenters within majoritarian societies. So that was the same language that the Catholics used in the Dutch Republic, where the Protestants were mildly persecutory and then simply a pain in the neck for a long, long time. And of course, it was the language of the Catholics in Ireland.
So it's the second point that I made that you agree with.
That's the one.
It's the relationship to power.
Yep. Yeah. And I think the language of rights and the right to dissent is the language of dissenters.
Yes.
And it's not a theological position. It's a relationship of power. That's why I want to see I want us to see rights as relational. It has everything to do with power. And the notion that the state generates rights is, I think, both historically and theoretically inaccurate. I mean, historically, the Bill of Rights in my country came out of a terrible struggle over the Constitution. And the people who wrote the Constitution, who constituted that state, didn't want to specify rights, and thank God they lost.
Why don't we throw it open to the audience?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Please.
Two comments or maybe questions. One is to Valerie. I enjoyed your presentation. And I want to ask you whether, you know, when you're talking about the racialization of Islam, isn't there a dialectics whereby the racialization of Islam also means racialization of Europe? Sort of in a contrast way. And this is also having to do with the comment that you made, Verinda. I agree that racism was always there, but I think that we have to take into account observations made by Bali Barz about new racism and Europe, actually whereby cultural signifiers substituting biological signifiers. And I think racism was there, yeah. But it is very important to see differences along, you know, the time axis, how it shades and takes new forms. And so, just this as a comment. And another a comment that I want to address to Anwar. I don't know whether your presentation was incomplete, but of course it left me a bit, you know, distressed. and I think many other people felt like that, you know. And what I mean by that, you know, you were talking about, of course, the practices of social exclusion and the relationship that it has with public good. And by saying incomplete, you know, you stopped there, you know, in the sense of you showed us that our social practices were usually subordinated to the public good. And you're saying that, well, that would be the destiny of minorities forever. And, of course, we cannot be satisfied with that. So what I'm suggesting, and probably you have thought about that, and this is what I mean by maybe your presentation was incomplete, I mean, the challenge in diverse societies is what? To expand and to reformulate the very idea of public good so that it would be able to accommodate minorities and the country. See, because, you know, to say what you just said, you know, in the sense that, you know, social exclusion enshrined and religious law and so forth and so on, it takes different forms today. And this is what many people talk about, regimes of legitimacy. But we cannot be satisfied, you know, well, while sort of explaining racism and social exclusion by saying, you know, and I think that you also mentioned that, you know, that it's subordinated to security concerns and other things like that and so forth and so on. And so one has to be very careful to see, you know, when there is sort of an excessive use of that, you know, regimes of legitimacy to justify practices of social exclusions.
So was my talk incomplete? It certainly, I will accept the criticism that it certainly wasn't very hopeful, that's for sure. I didn't leave us with a nice, you know, yeah, no, I take the criticism. And I'll be frank with you, it's not one that I didn't intend it to be incomplete. That is actually part of where I have left off thus far on that project. And I think part of the reason why is at this point in my scholarship, it is committed to clearing the ground. There's a lot of ground clearing that I think needs to happen. So let me give you a couple examples of what I mean by that and why I think that it's premature for me to offer that second part that I think maybe everyone was hoping for. And I'll tell you why. I'm involved in this project on Islamic and international human rights law, and it arose out of a recognition that so much of the conversation on Islam and human rights is about lists. Islamic law has this value, international law has that value. Oh, how wonderful they match. Let's sing kumbaya. And that's oftentimes how these conversations go. And I was at The Hague at the Peace Palace. There was an Egyptian judge sitting giving a talk. And he was talking about the principle of equality in Islam and how it's so present it would enshrine an Islamic humanitarian law system of equality. At which point I then asked him, I see, so then are you making an Islamic argument, an Islamic humanitarian law argument for international intervention in Egypt on grounds of persecution of the Baha'is and others? At which point he said, well, you know, equality takes different shapes and forms. And so at that level, to me, conversation about these abstracts is cheap talk. And it seems to me then what I need to do is figure out how cheap talk is operating on both sides. I find that the Islamic discourse and the treatment of non-Muslims equally troubling. The Indian consulate of Jeddah used to have a statement to its expats working in the Arabian Peninsula on wrongful death damages. If you are killed by someone, by a car, your relatives can have statutory maximums on wrongful death damages. If you're a Muslim male, 100,000 Saudi riyals. Christian or Jewish male, 50,000 Saudi riyals. Anything else, 6,667.67 Saudi riyals. The fractions happen to correspond with a pre-model Hanbali rule of law that said for Muslim males who were killed, 100 camels. For Jews and Christians, 50 camels. And for anyone else, 1/15th of what a Muslim male would get. 1/15 of $100,000 is $6,667.67. So there's a direct correlation between the Saudi rule and at the same time, I have the Saudi government signing on to humanitarian interventions and humanitarian conventions, of course, with reservations in favor of Sharia, without ever defining what that is. So to me, it is cheap talk. And part of what I want to do then is recognize that both are being used by both sides, the human rights advocates as well as the Islamic law advocates, in ways to manipulate the other. And what my goal then is to, in a sense, deconstruct both sides of the debate. And that's what that project is about. Human rights scholars looking at how human rights discourse is itself a constructed discourse without a real end in sight. And likewise, Islamic law discourses, both being discourses of governance. And so in that sense, the project lends itself to Wendy Brown, to Foucault, and others who have this conversation about power. Am I sad that I'm not offering you something? I'm in the company of James Tully and Anthony Angie. Angie says international law is potentially a reinstantiation of the colonial paradigm. That's heavy, and that's really sad. And he doesn't leave us with an alternative, and he's not going to. I think a lot of us in this area of work are struggling with the fact that we're simply here trying to clear the ground. As possibilities, I offer to you acceptance of what Francis has talked about, but also as a possible way of thinking about it. You know, you talked about Islamic law and gender in Muslim countries, and I would want to add a slight corrective to that. It's Islamic law as legislated in statutory enactments, in personal status laws by Muslim states, oftentimes trying to use certain versions of Islamic law to bolster their political legitimacy. So when I look at those states, the al-ahwal al-shakhsiyya, those statutes, I have to ask myself, well, where are they getting those doctrines from? How are they pulling it together? And at what cost do we push for reform? If I push for reform on purely human rights grounds, I will be dismissed by those governments as westernizing agents. A new development in the last 5 years has been the rise of Islamic feminism. Many feminist groups might think that that's an oxymoron, but in fact, I find the work of these groups fascinating and have been fortunate to be brought into some of the work of Musawa, which in Arabic means equality, but is a group that's been spun off by Zaina Anwar, who was the founder of Sisters in Islam, former executive director of it, and she's now the head of this project. And the idea is to think how to work locally in light of commitments to principles like human rights, but very much taking the Islamic tradition as a starting point. If we are working in these conditions and these circumstances where Islam is a reality, it is a value system equal in value to many as human rights, how do we bring them together? And there is a movement from the international to the domestic to the local that they're trying to negotiate by bringing in local players, bringing in scholars, bringing in activists, and trying to get them to talk to one another. It's messy business. But it's, in my experience, in the few years I've been working with them, it's been tremendously rewarding. So that's my wrap-up. And it's not much more hopeful than that, but it's a bit more complete, I hope.
Valerie?
Thank you. Thank you for the question, because it gives me the possibility to get deeper into what I couldn't say during the 10 minutes. Post-colonialism, Orientalism, of course, we know that. And even if French scholars were the latecomers into this discussion, it's almost impossible now to start a sentence in France with Muslim in it without falling into this postcolonial discourse. But it doesn't reach to what I'm describing here. What I'm trying to make sense of is how come in such a nationally differentiated perspective, space, political, juridical, economic, and cultural space, the rationalization of Muslims is happening. And by rationalization, I'm very close to what you were just describing, meaning how does a category such as Turks / Moroccans becoming all of a sudden, all over the last 8 years, Muslims, with something more tricky inside? Because it's not only that Dutch are considering Moroccans and Turks as Muslims. They're considering Moroccans as bad Muslims.
That's right.
And Turks as good Muslims, meaning I was in the Netherlands because Metropolis had this big conference in Den Haag at the beginning of the week. The huge discussion about Geert Wilders being trialed was the impact of this 10 years long discussion around him and all the satellites issue Tova Van Gogh, Esti Ali, and all these persons, and the impact of that on the naturalization in the public opinion, meaning newspapers, policymakers, NGO activists, of the idea that Moroccans are bad Muslims. Bad Muslims because of their incapacity to make sense of men-women equality. Nothing to see with the past of the colonial experience of the Netherlands in Morocco, if I may. Another illustration, the German context. Turks in Germany. And most of the asylum seekers are not Turk. They're coming from other Muslim countries. What is happening in Germany, again, after the headache that happened to them on the 12th of September 2001? They just decided that they should file and really fight and identify who are the potential suspects that are trying to enter Germany, because one of the killers, supposed killers of the terrorist attack was Mohamed Atta, who happened to have been socialized at the university in Hamburg. What did they do? They tried to create something that was very effective, very performative in the sense that we use the word in sociology, a system that enabled the state, and here comes the effective racialization process, to enable the state to check inside European citizenries who were eventually the suspects and who were not. Where do you check? Where do you check if people would eventually be loyal to Germany as Muslims? You check that with the test of citizenship. And the test of citizenship is not only dealing with linguistic skills. It's dealing with three very effective questions, dealing with what is your relationship to homosexuality? What would be your reaction if your son happens one evening to tell you that he's an homosexual? And what do you think of public officers declaring publicly, making their public coming out, saying, I'm a policymaker, I'm elected at the SPD or CDU or CSU, and I'm an homosexual? As a Muslim, what do you think? We're in the office, and it's purely discretionary, of an official, a civil servant, that is deciding at the end if this person is eligible or not to citizenship. Another example that is really not dealing with post-colonialism in the sense of we were colonial powers and we are not anymore is the Swiss case. I was glad that Enver reminded you and me of this wonderful campaign poster. This is the racialization at its climax. It means we're in Switzerland, where most of the Muslims, 90% of them, and I love the New York Times on that. I don't always love it, but I loved it that day of they covered the referendum results. 90% of them comes from Kosovo and Turkey. Flashback, the campaign posters. You have this black niqab figure of a woman, head-to-toe veil, on the flag. The flag is on the territory. It's really, the map is not the territory, but in that case, the territory is really the map. It's red, it's black, it's white, and you have these minarets looking like missiles. Now, how many Muslims do we have? Not important. How many mosques do we have with minarets? 4 in Switzerland. How many were planned to be built with minarets? 2. Yes. Meaning, on something that is basically not existing as a public problem, as a public issue, you have 57% of the persons that said no to something that is not a problem. And I love newspapers, because first page of Le Temps, the day after, meaning 1st December 2009, on Monday, Chapat, I hope you know him. If you don't, check on the internet, because he's always commenting his own caricature. It's like the Plantu of Le Monde, but the Swiss version, so with accent. And he made this wonderful caricature where you saw a typical, you know, what you expect Switzerland to look like. It's green, there is this mountain, it's where chocolate, yeah, where chocolate is made, you know, cows, the milk production, it's perfect. And you have this wonderful woman, couple, and they're dressed like peasants, Swiss peasants, so it's a bit chic. And the journalist is here with a question. It's the day after the referendum. And apparently there is no mosque in this area. But still the question is, so, what do you think? And the comment of the man is, and the comment of the woman is, on ne doit pas se voiler la face, which is absolutely not to be translated exactly in English, but basically I shouldn't cover my head. And I should tell you the truth. What I think is that minarets should be out of Switzerland. This is another illustration of what I intend with racialization, meaning how a category is becoming active in the way a larger audience made of lawyers, judges, policymakers, NGO activists, grocery holders, my grandmother, consider Muslims to be different and to be legitimate to treat them differently. Last comment. The only persons who really tracked the impact of a religious variable on discrimination of Muslims in France is an American scholar. Mm-hmm. David Layton, Stanford yes. University. He made this wonderful study, and he took postcolonialism seriously. He didn't make his study on North African descent. He did it on Senegalese women, a particular part of the population of a Senegalese village where half of them are Christians, half of them are Muslims. And he designed this fake curriculum, indicating, of course, with a controlled comparative sample, he indicated in the curriculum that there were being activists in the Catholic Scoutism movement, that the other one was implicated as a volunteer in an Islamic association, whatever. And the result is striking. In 75% of the case, there were no answer at all to the Muslim-identified curriculum. And when it was a positive answer, like we are interviewing you, it was less than 2% of recruitment, with equal competencies, equal skills, equal correspondence to the definition of the position. So when I say racialization, I refer to the way a process of objectification of what a Muslim is becoming something natural that is operational at many, many levels, including at security levels, control of ID control, ID check in public spaces, selection of migrants, selection of asylum-seeking applications and refugee demand, accumulation or intersection of discrimination by implementation of the law, police arrest, etc., etc. There are a lot of studies that goes into that direction, and it's, of course, a problem, because we are again facing a phenomenon, a process that is happening in contexts where, on the one hand, multiculturalism is said to have gone wide. On the other hand, republicanism is said to have failed. So it's not about philosophy of integration. It's something else that is producing this capacity of performance of the category. Thank you.
Francis?
Yes, just one remark about... totally in empathy, and I hope that my paper, I wanted to say it's clear that the discourse in Europe has to be affected by racial hatred, which is underlying a lot of the discourse. But coming back to Avner Amon's comments, you seem to me to make symmetrical, a certain symmetry between the problems of Islam in relating to human rights, women's, homosexuals, whatever it may be, and the problem of the human rights agenda. And you represented them as symmetrical, and I felt that when you were talking, I certainly agree that any hermeneutics within religion, which allow religions and those who are disadvantaged within religion, because it's not going to be the religions, those who are disadvantaged within religion, to move forward are more than welcome. But it seems to me that all three monotheistic religions have quite a hard job to promote equality for these different groups, to promote freedom of opinion, freedom from religion, freedom of choice in religion. I mean, gender inequality, prohibition of homosexuality, apostasy, heresy, those are the legacies of the three monotheisms. Human rights, since before 1948, but codified in 1948, and I here turn very strongly to what Dr. Langley said, were a move forward in the human imagination as to what it was to allow the individual to thrive with a level of autonomy and choice which doesn't exist under any of the three religions. It was Susan B. Anthony said in the Seneca Falls, she said, to no religion does woman owe one impulse of liberty. And it's not just women, it's certainly homosexuals. And it's in fact those who think differently. It's the heretics. And those are the values that have been given to us by the human rights regime. So I wanted to ask how you relate to Dr. Langley's remarks about, you know, there is a universality about the concept of human rights. It doesn't matter where they were developed or by whom they were developed. There's a universality as regards all human beings who are being oppressed. And the religions did not provide an easy course to deal with that. And from that I wanted to say that along with the hermeneutics within religion, which I understand both strategically and tactically, along with that, states, human rights activists, and intellectuals have to say, take responsibility for saying we need constitutional principles, human rights principles, and a right of exit for those who do not want to suffer the oppression imposed on them by religion until religions have accepted these wonderful hermeneutic glosses.
That's a great set of questions, actually. And I think the reason why let me clarify that the reason I'm able to put them in an asymmetrical position in some sense is because I'm not speaking about them in doctrinal terms only. I'm not just thinking of human rights as what's in the Universal Declaration, nor am I thinking of Islamic law as what's in a medieval fiqh book. But what I recognize is that both of these are traditions that are fed through institutions. So, for instance, if you take the Turkey versus Shaheen case at the European Court of Human Rights, sure, that was an Article 9 case on right to religious freedom. And sure, there was a debate about whether or not there was an infringement or whether there wasn't an infringement, or if there was an infringement, was it justifiable? But if you really look at the majority decision there, it's all based on margin of appreciation. Margin of appreciation is a legal doctrine within the court that recognizes to a certain degree that we must pay heed to the national definition of what is and isn't democratic and necessary for Turkey by basically yielding to Turkey's views. And so there you have a court charged with the upholding of a human rights provision, but what that provision means is fed through an institutional process that is not necessarily clear to me. And when Justice Tulkins writes in dissent in that particular decision, and for those of you who don't know, this was Leyla Shaheen was a Turkish woman who was denied access to the universities in Turkey because she wore a headscarf. She went all the way to the European Court of Human Rights and lost. The court decided that she did not have a right that was infringed, and the margin of appreciation was a doctrine well established in the court's doctrines to justify that outcome. Justice Tulkins argues in dissent that there was no reference to the actual harm being threatened here. In Shabina Begum, in the United Kingdom, another reference to the European Convention of Human Rights, Article 9, a young girl was asking to have an exception to the uniform requirement to wear the jilbab, and she was invoking her rights. In fact, her brother was invoking his rights. Her rights, and while it's absolutely fair for them to invoke their rights, the problem that almost every judge on the House of Lords speech was that, gosh, they were awfully arrogant about the way they invoked those rights. And it's interesting how, you know, it's that they really seemed really hostile, they seemed really aggressive in the way they became awfully litigious. And there's a wonderful article in which there's a concern about how to deal with the fact that when people outside the system adopt the language of the system, when you adopt the language of rights, you're nonetheless, it's seemingly unseemly. So when you have a brown set of folks invoking the language of the law and the rights, the judges were disturbed by the tenor. You can see the same argument being made with Park 51. The Ground Zero Mosque, which isn't really at Ground Zero, but you can make a freedom of art, you make a freedom of religion claim that certainly preserves their right to build, but what's the concern? It's insensitive. And my concern is that rights are fueled and funneled through political processes. So with Islamic law, yes, I have rules on apostasy, but I also know that in the... in the case of in Malaysia, what was the case? I can't remember the name of the case. Lina Joy, yeah. So in the Lina Joy case, was that about an Islamic law issue? The High Court decided on an issue of administrative law and granted discretion to the national. My point then being is that while you may be concerned that I'm creating a symmetry between doctrines, my concern is that you're not seeing the way in which doctrines are never debated in the are never experienced in the abstract, but take form in local context. And I want to invoke in that case the example of our South African colleague from yesterday.
I would just like to answer on that on two things. Firstly, I am not saying that every human right is properly applied, but I am saying the axiom of human rights gives far more freedom and equality than the axiom of what is written in the Quran, the Old Testament, or the New Testament, any of the three books of authority. And that since most of these books of authority are carried out by patriarchal hierarchies and interpreted by them to the exclusion of women and homosexuals, the likelihood that they will be interpreted better than the human rights in the Universal Declaration is rather small. That's the first thing. Secondly, the Begum case. The Begum case was a case in which there was a Muslim headmistress who had introduced a modest uniform for Muslim girls in that school of tunics and trousers. And the parents of the Muslim community there had agreed in a very organized process to use this as the way of dress for Muslim girls. And as you very clearly pointed out, the brother of the girl. And that is very significant because in family honor, brothers take an extraordinarily active role and usually a rather negative role in Islamic societies. The brother of the girl insisted that she wear the jilbab. She afterwards came out very strongly and said she wanted it, I have to say. But the court said there is a community decision. The jilbab is the garment that comes over the chin, over the eyebrows, down to the fingertips, and completely covers the feet. A young girl cannot have freedom of movement in the jilbab. And the community had agreed what with the Muslim headmistress what they wanted for modest dress. So I think it's rather unfair to say that the court decided because of the arrogance of the petitioner to ignore the desires of the Muslim community in I can't remember the name of the area in which it was.
Denby High School.
I can't remember the area of England in which it was. So I think here that the court made an amazingly wise decision to actually allow both the process to listen to the Muslim community, and I want to bring out here what Patrick Wild said when he sat down, he was on the committee to decide about legislation in France to prohibit the headscarf in schools. Now, I agree with you about the Laila Sahin case, because this was an adult woman. She was studying medicine in a university. If she decided she wanted to wear the headscarf, whether she was indoctrinated or not indoctrinated, it's too late to give her another choice for the society to do it. I mean, one can give education, films, literature, whatever you like. You can't prohibit her as a way of educating an adult woman who has enough independence to go out and study in a university. But in the schools, it was a different matter. And in the French public schools, Patrick Weil and his committee originally did not intend to prohibit the scarves, headscarves in schools. They did not intend to, but they then heard witnesses giving evidence, girls from public schools in France who said, if you don't prohibit the headscarf, every Muslim girl in France will be wearing a headscarf tomorrow because we're being threatened by the boys in schools, we're being threatened by some of the more fundamentalist families. There was an organization of French women, Ni Soumise, Ni Putain, who asked for the prohibition to be kept in place because they, the Muslim women of France, wanted protection for their girls against patriarchal pressures. So that this is a very complex issue. And what gives us hope is the human right of women and of homosexuals to be who they are with an equal opportunity to experience life as men have.
Thanks for that, Francis and Amber. I just wanted to add a little bit of to contribute to this conversation in terms of, in the context of India and in terms of being a family law lawyer, practicing Muslim law, being a human rights activist, etc., and also teaching Muslim law. What I'd like to say is that I think I agree with Francis that for minority women, and specifically for Muslim women in India, they have a far better chance of protecting and forwarding their claims to equality by appealing to universal values that paradoxically a concession to cultural relativism might preclude. So I just want to emphasize that.
I just wanted to ask one question to Francis then, because you made it quite clear, and I don't think you're necessarily wrong in this, but it does raise the question about possibilities. If you say that the three monotheistic traditions are inherently patriarchal, that the universal values of human rights are the best chance, what do you say to the Islamic feminists like Ziba Mir Hosseini, Zaina Anwar, who have been at the forefront of that? I mean, are they delusional?
I represented the Women of the Wall, who are the Jewish version of Orthodox Jewish feminists. What they wanted to do is pray in the same way as men do in the public space of the central symbolic space beside the western wall of the ancient temple in Jerusalem. And the violent ultra-Orthodox men and women, and Orthodox men and women, not only ultra-Orthodox, wasn't just fundamentalists, were violent. They didn't want them to pray with prayer shawls, with the Torah scroll, and out loud in a group, because all these things offended rules of the Jewish religion, which are patriarchal. One is women's voices should not be heard in song by men because it distracts them. Another is women should not wear men's clothing because it's arrogant. Thirdly, women should not hold the Torah scroll because, by feminist analysis, they shouldn't get too close to the seat of learning. And they shouldn't raise their voices because, like the Greek sirens, I mean, it's going to tempt men to their deaths. And, you know, what you do, you don't control the men, you shut up the women. So these women, they asked me, will you represent me? I said, I'll represent you with every ounce of my strength. They said, will you pray with us? I said, no, I won't pray with you, and I won't pray without you, but I will represent you. And I did represent them, and we had some great successes in court and some failures. In the end, we got some kind of compromise, which was far from ideal. I supported them because I think the religion is here to stay. I'm not saying what I would prefer to see it do, but it is here to stay, and it's very important to, as democracy, you know, when men got the vote in America, women were in favor of blacks getting the vote and women getting the vote. When the French gave the vote to the Third Estate in France, women fought, women revolutionaries, for women to get the vote, as well as the Third Estate to get the vote. In both places, they failed. In America, it took another 50 years before the women got the vote. In France, it took till 1944 before women got the vote. So that was a couple of centuries. But I am saying, yes, I support every woman, including these Muslim women, to fight within the religion for change. But that does not absolve us of the responsibility, while we're waiting for them to succeed, of giving them options through the international law and constitutional law systems. We can't just sit and wait until the light strikes.
A brief comment from two of our panelists, and I know there's some more questions from the floor.
I'll reply to Anwar because I work on Islamic feminism. I work with Ziba and also with Sisters in Islam. And my point is I don't think it's a matter of debate or question. The interpretation of Islam is patriarchal. There's no question. The way that religion is practiced today, the way it's interpreted, is patriarchal. And part of the reason for that is women have not been included in that debate. So we have Ziba, who is an Islamic feminist. She's a woman of faith, and she's involved in a project of reinterpreting the Quran, reinterpreting the Sharia to read in a feminist interpretation. Fantastic. But I think I agree with Francis, and that goes back to my point, that I think we have to deconstruct the binary between what is religious, what is a true feminist woman, and a modern Islamic woman. And it also goes back to the point of the political context. In Iran, the political context is quite different, where women don't have much choice but what they can appeal to in terms of forwarding their rights. So in terms of creating a feminist agenda, well, if you need to have cultural legitimacy for lasting change, then you have to work within the constraints of that regime. So in Iran, for example, which Ziba works on, there is no recognition by the state of gender equality in the way that we see it, say, in universal human rights. So, I think it's an excellent thing. It's a fantastic idea to keep working for internal reform in religion. But that doesn't preclude the fact that women should have the choice to choose between appealing to universal norms of equality to forward their understanding of themselves and to insist on the enforcing of their rights as women. So whether it's as Islamic women or feminists, I think we need to take a step back, try and understand who's had the right to define culture, what does culture mean, and who deploys arguments of culture always as a shield against granting women greater rights. So I think we have to deconstruct religion, culture, tradition, because in most cases we have to name the agency in who created these oppressive customs and who are the people it affects the most. In the case of Muslim women and minority racialized women, it's always the debate contested on women's bodies. So we're obsessed with the veil, we're obsessed with niqab and all these kinds of issues. But we're not talking about the fact that, for example, in France, the whole idea of secularism itself wasn't particularly friendly to women in the way it was constructed and constituted. And democracy itself is based on particular inclusions and exclusions, and I think we've recognized that on the other hand as well. So I think that we need to close the gap between the religious and the secular. And in Iran, we have a fantastic example of secular feminists and Muslim feminists working together for a common agenda, and that agenda is women's equality.
Brenda said pretty much, because I was going to, of course, you know, I'm an outsider to all of this very fascinating discussion and the exchange is going on. And one thing that I was, you know, going to share was partly what you just mentioned, Virinda, at the end, that you know, we tend to lump, you know, especially those from the outsider perspective, like myself and the Western media and the public, you know, understanding, we tend to lump everything into one category. You call it Islam or whatever. But in that package is a religion, culture, tradition, and these cultures and traditions may be very different from the North African experience of Muslim, and Persian version, mm-hmm. and the Arab version, and the Indonesian version. So I think there is a huge kind of diversity in the whole Islamic world. And what I worry is, you know, once again, that by bringing, you know, in this very public and vocal discourse, dialectical discourse that is taking place right now between Islamic perspective versus international kind of jurisprudence or human rights-based kind of legal systems, is a kind of a certain essentialization and stratification of what is referred to as the Islam. And as we know from history that although, you know, this is certainly the case in the Indian experience, although religious traditions will invoke the authority of sacred texts, but the fact is, throughout human history, we have always adapted the understanding of those sacred texts according to the contemporary needs of a given society. I mean, that's why there is hermeneutics. You know, you can see a hermeneutic tradition in the Islamic tradition, you can see a hermeneutic tradition in Judaism, in Hinduism, in Buddhism. We see all of this, and human beings are very capable, we are fluid, and we adapt. So to some extent, you know, I mean, my concern is that by, you know, sometimes I worry that on the part of the proponent of human rights discourse, there is a certain reluctance to be more assertive, partly because on the European Western side there is a colonial history, and along with that comes a certain sense of embarrassment and shame. And also, particularly the academics, are terribly worried of being labeled as, you know, hegemonic and, you know, subscribing to the modernist, rationalistic kind of, you know, mode of inquiry. And in the process, what I worry is the dilution of what we have achieved as human species. And then taking a particular version of Islamic jurisprudence, or whether it is, you know, Confucius, you know, ideal of society, then somehow trying to kind of, for the sake of PC, you know, political correctness and accommodation of multiplicity of voices, I think there's a real danger that, you know, what we have achieved as a human species can be lost in the process. So that's actually, you know, a major concern for me, partly because, you know, I am a member of a displaced society, community, and we understand the, you know, experience of what it means to be displaced, marginalized, and what it means to live under a particular domination of a certain authoritarian ideology. So, I mean, that's why I get terribly worried when the cultural relativism is brought in to really dilute the fundamental human rights discourse.
There were some questions from the floor. Please.
I have a question, or two questions, or two comments. I didn't decide yet. When you were talking, especially now with the comments, the thing that came to my mind was imperialism of rights. And Verinda, you made it very clear. The danger of appealing to universal rights, as much as equality and dignity and human dignity are very important, is risking the women, minority women, with appealing to very great ideas of equality, but without really real means to enforce them. Mm-hmm. And that reminds me of a story when I was a human rights lawyer in Israel, and that's not an oxymoron. I had a client. Her name is, I call her Samar, and hence her name also, I call her Summer School, because it was a case that concerns schools. She got married. She was 18. She got married and got pregnant, in that order, obviously. And she told me in a community project that I had that she was barred from going to school. And I told her, what do you mean you're not allowed to go to school? You have a right to go to school. There is a law in Israel, mandatory education right for you to go to school. She was actually 17. So she said, no, the principal told me not to come to school. So I was with my students. So two of my students obviously immediately, you have a right to go to school. What do you mean? It's right to education, right? Dignity, human dignity. And all I did was actually listening to her and thinking, okay, she's married, and it has nothing to do with her being Muslim. It has to do with her being a woman in a patriarchal society. I asked myself whether I'm risking her by telling her that she has rights to education. And I wanted her to discuss that with her husband. And I had a huge conflict afterwards with my clients whether I played into the rules of patriarchy by telling her that she has a right, but she doesn't have to enforce it if she has problems with her husband afterwards. Because what happens is that I feel that sometimes we sell dreams to people that don't really have means to fulfill them. And that, especially within minority women, that their identities, there are several intersecting identities in their lives. And that brings me to Francis. You were talking about Israel, and you were talking mostly about Palestinians and Jews as a whole, but there is a huge conflict within Jewish society between Ashkenazi and Mizrahi Jews, especially on the notion of religion and sacralization, because the way that Sephardic Jews were basically severely discriminated in Israel was through the idea of secularizing them. photos of soldiers cutting their payas in the 50s are very, very strong photos that I still remember. So for me, that was a bit lacking from your intro to the Israeli story, because it's much more complicated than it is. Speaking of the notion of Jewish and democratic, there's actually a big debate about the democracy of the Jewish state, not from the Palestinian side or the Muslim side or the Christian Muslim and Arab side, but actually within the intra-Jewish issue. So a comment and frustration. Or thank you.
Please.
Yes, just a very brief comment or question to all the panelists. Do you see that you have spoken about religion or politics? Are you really on your disciplinary domains to say, yes, maybe it's not about religious diversity, it's about political diversity? We have spoken. How do you react?
We have two questions, and they're addressed to all the panelists. Do we have responses?
Are we speaking about religion? Are we speaking about politics? Are we speaking about fundamental rights? Are we fundamental human rights? Or are we speaking about political rights?
I completely agree. It's about politics. Religion is a great absentee, according to me, of this argument, and in a way it's logical. It belongs to the way the discussion should go, and the margin of appreciation, I appreciate that you refer to that, because I think it's a very slippery slope in the European way to deal with religion as with religious freedom as individual rights, because what margin of appreciation says basically is a political answer to a question of individual right to express visibly a specific belief that belongs to the right of conscience. By the way, religion is absent from the legal discussion, at least in half of the context we're talking about in the EU member states. No one talks about religious freedom. Everyone talks about the right to religious to freedom of conscience. There is no religious law in most of the countries. So religion is also in itself a problem of definition for the poor judges that are left alone in their chair and have to answer and give classification of what is something that seems to be religious. A good comparison for that is the way the Canadian Supreme Court dealt with the Kirpan, not entering into any discussion about its religious qualification. While in European context, the first thing we did is to say it's a political / security / religious science. So we attribute definition, and it's, according to me, a slippery slope, because in the case of margin of appreciation, it leads us through the Council of Europe and through the European Court of Human Rights to a situation in which the secular Europe is a secular Europe in which politics control religion, which is the case in Turkey. And the margin of appreciation saying the Turkish state has the right and autonomy to decide whether or not this is a security and political issue is something that is referring to the way the secularism was established from bottom up, from top down, by the political elite. And it says basically religion should be controlled by politics, which is not the case in France. In France, officially, we have legal incompetency of religion / politics. And same thing in Germany. We have cooperation, but legal incompetency. And that is complicated, because in the UK it's different, in Denmark also. So in a way, the European Court of Human Rights is telling us no religion community policy, that's fine, but a slight interest in keeping political authorities in control of what they say about the way believers, whatever communities they belong to, behave. Mm-hmm. So I think it's politics. And it's, you know, we're normal, but it is.
I think it's both. I cannot analyze religion out of existence beyond politics and economics and so on. There are people who do. Marxists say it's all of a question of economics. You know, there's no really religious... I think that religion is a very deeply institutionalized phenomenon. It has political implications, but if you mean politics meaning the politics of the state, it has its own set of politics. I think that religion and religious institutions have their own set of politics. And the interplay between democratic politics or totalitarian politics and religion don't remove, and I'm not sure if this is what you meant by your question, but don't remove the very idiosyncratic, unique, authentic politics and power of religion and religious institutions. I don't know if that relates to what you said quite.
My question was, what is the reflexivity of an academic community to frame the question about religious diversity if we are speaking about power?
Look, I think... I don't know quite what you mean by that.
I'm not sure I do either.
I don't know quite what you mean by that.
Can I suggest
I would like to just go back to the question about diversity in Israel, if I may. I'd be delighted to hear afterwards a much longer explanation. Going back to within Israel, yeah, religion, it might relate to the previous question, religion is manipulated and used by politicians. I mean, that's clear by throughout the centuries. And so when you talk about the divisions within the Jewish society, I didn't relate to them because I do not think that they are nearly as severe as the divisions between the Jewish and the Arab society. I don't think that the Sephardi Jews are discriminated against in any kind of way in which the Arabs have been discriminated against. Though I discussed their rights, that does not mean that they have not been disadvantaged as a minority community in Israel. They have been, and I think far more than the Sephardi have. However, that does not mean that this is not an important question. It's just that I didn't get round to it. And I'm interested to hear, I did not know that the religious aspects have been used in this context.
Just on that religion and politics question, one of the things that I've been asking myself is, how are we defining religion? How are we engaging it? And how are we distinguishing it from any other disciplinary subject? And one of the things I've been struggling with in thinking about that question is, what are some of the presumptions that we assume that make religion vibrant? And as a lawyer, I'm going to put this in legal terms only because that's how I think. It may not be the way you think, but hopefully it might at least convey the idea, is that oftentimes with freedom of religion provisions, the limitations are on manifestation. Mm-hmm. So you're free to believe your religious belief, but you may not be able to always manifest it in society. The court can put limitations. But what happens in some traditions where belief and manifestation are not so easily separable? So, for instance, if I were a Muslim woman and I believed God commands me to be modest, what does that mean? I have to manifest that in society. The sheer manifestation of that belief is political in the sense that it puts me in relationship with you. It communicates something about my sense of being embodied in the world with you. And in that sense, then, if you combine belief and manifestation, not so easily separated, then I would argue the notion of the religious as distinct from the political as disciplines perhaps collapses. Or rather, to preserve the distinction between the two is to accept a certain conception of the religious as purely about belief, as purely about the individual with his or her God, or with his or her supreme being or creator, which then suggests a particular notion of religion, perhaps a more Protestant notion of religion, that then informs the very way in which we construe the right to religious freedom. That's simply one example. And so there are some who suggest that not only are the rights, and I think that was what one of the earlier speakers was suggesting, and certainly what Talal Assad was suggesting, that one way of thinking about rights is not just simply to think of them as products of a secular Europe, but to think of them as a Judeo-Christian tradition that led to a secularization that contributed content to these values. Can we escape the fact that the notion of the rights that we hold dear are post-Protestant? Perhaps, but it might suggest ways for us to think and reflect on the way what presumptions allow certain divisions and discipline to exist. I hope that was helpful.
May I just take the presumptuous opportunity to pose one question that probably can't be answered in any small amount of time. But we've spent a lot of time talking about religion through a political lens, the specific lens of human rights, with the assumption that human rights are essential, they're basic, they're universal. What is our response to the theological critique of human rights as themselves being religious and a false religion, namely that it's a worship of human beings rather than a worship of God? Is that something that can be dealt with, or is it inevitable that there is no discourse once we get to that divergence?
I don't think I'll start off.
I
don't have an immediate thing.
No, it reminds me of a situation that took place in France when the current president was Minister of the Interior and was helping and supporting and actively, after 9/11, engaged in the process of creating a board of representatives for the Muslim community in France. This was finally elected in 2003, and historically it's something unique, and it's a long story per se. But the situation is the following. There was this discussion about aren't you going too far and too fast in helping Muslims, and including inviting the bad guys, because he invited to the table of negotiation associations that were until then excluded as because being radicals. And he was interviewed during a huge TV show that took place in the evening at a time of large audience. And he had asked, as Minister of Interior, to be interviewed in opposition or in contrast with Tariq Ramadan. And I'm referring to Tariq Ramadan because Tariq Ramadan is a French-speaking Muslim and an English-speaking Muslim. He's traveling a lot, is present everywhere, and very often in Montreal, and it's always controversial. So it's a controversial figure with a controversial Minister of Interior. And the discussion goes as follows, and I'm taking that from the first chapter of one of Olivier Roy's book, which is called Global Islam. And in the first chapter, Olivier Roy describes the scene as I saw it on TV, meaning we have a Minister of Interior who is also in charge of organizing worship. That falls under his competency in the French context. And meaning the institutional existence of religion, sticking to practices. And he says, Tariq Ramadan, okay, we've understood you're a modern Muslim. You're very advanced, you're well-educated, you speak many languages, you travel a lot, but are you in favor or against stones throwing on Muslim women that are victims or that have committed adultery? And Ramadan answers to a similar question as you, saying, as a citizen, I'm condemning that. I'm against it with all my soul. As a Muslim, I don't have the competence to answer. This was the beginning of the headscarf controversies. It was Eastern. It was Eastern holidays, and it was the starting point of the law forbidding the veil. I take the opportunity that I have the microphone to come back on what was said earlier on the Stasi Commission and Patrick Veil, and I invite you to read again the best thing that has been written by a Stasi Commission member on that commission, published in Quebec, because it was the only way for him to get his voice heard right after the end of the work of the commission. To make a long story short, the commission was the one that deliberated for months about the possibility and the constitutionality and the interest of having a law banning the headscarf. It was not formulated that way, but they never interviewed Muslim veiled women until the last week. The process of interviewing was completely conducted from the presidency, not Sarkozy, Chirac at that time, by direct order being given to the person who was in charge of drafting the report. And all that has been written publicly by Jean Bobéro, who was the only voice who was against voting the final proposal of the report. So to answer your question, I think it's not the proper purpose of a scholar, as at least of a political scientist or a sociologist, to engage in conversation with theology. It is the purpose of theologians, from other confessions, other denominations, to discuss that. And I think that is missing in the interfaith dialogue, in particular, as set up by the United Nations, yeah? Mm-hmm. The Dialogue on Civilization. Because precisely, they're not discussing the hot topics. They are not discussing the thing on which the community of believers and the theologians disagree. And that's not my job to discuss with them. I'm interested in reading it, but I'm not discussing it.
May I say, I think it is very much our job to discuss it. And I think that human rights and secular constitutionalism, I'm not talking about belief, I'm talking about secular constitutionalism and human rights, and indeed human rights are the product of secular constitutionalism, of secular thinking, of secular state organization. And I think that the big difference between them and any theology are that they are enabling. They enable difference, they enable pluralism, they enable individual choice, and they enable community choice. Freedom of religion is high on the list of rights guaranteed by human rights regimes. And therefore, when you look at any single religion, each religion regards itself as right. There is some level at which it regards itself as authoritative and excludes choice in some way or other. And that is true of all three monotheisms. And the fatwa is still used in Islam. You talked about the decision of the European Court of Human Rights on Laila Sahin. And I agreed with you that I don't like that decision. I think the decision was wrong. But there's a process there, and it can be changed, and it can be argued. A fatwa ends in death, not in argument. And I must say that I think that the question has to be answered very firmly, that human rights and religious doctrine are not equal and opposite. They are not symmetrical. Human rights must respect religion, but must also limit religion.
Okay, I'm going to give, since we seem to really be into it, I'm going to give everybody a chance. Brenda, Anver, and then you.
I think I'm of the opposite view. I think that we have a responsibility to engage in dialogue with religious leaders. I think part of a pragmatic engagement and constructive dialogue is an essential part of it. And I think it would be a big mistake to say that we're not willing to have a conversation with you first. The second point, I think we need to understand that religion is not something that's immutable and divine. Religion is lived culture. It changes over time. It responds to social changes, cultural changes. So I think it's a big mistake to think of religion as an ahistorical tradition. It's fluid, it changes, and there are many versions of what is religion within the religious tradition itself.
I'd like to underscore that as well. And just from my own experience, looking at people who consider themselves survival of repression in the period that I was talking about, one of the mechanisms that I use as a scholar to account for the survival of people under very severe repression is the kind of adaptation of their own culture that you talked about. In the circumstances of repression, people can't live pure religion. And so they engage in a kind of mental activity by which they adjust their own religion to their circumstances and say, well, pure religion requires us to do this and to do it publicly, but in order to survive, we have to do it privately. We have to do it secretively. And over time, that kind of adaptation has really important results for the experience of the religious community. Irish Catholicism is perhaps the most obvious case in point, because without priestly or hierarchical leadership, they nevertheless maintained a whole series of religious practices that were eventually contested by a reestablished church, and that church was never purified from a top-down point of view. It always remained the adapted church that it became under that experience. And I think you could say the same thing about about Calvinists in southern France or the southern Netherlands or in Austria or whatever. That adaptability to circumstances is very important, and I think we can presume to be part of that conversation.
Two more comments.
As someone who actually does study Islamic theology, there are ways to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. Just a brief plug, I actually outlined possibilities in a book that I just finished, Islamic Natural Law Theories. But it's hard. It's hard work, mm-hmm. because the theological presuppositions assume certain theories of knowledge that we don't always accept mm-hmm. today. It's hard because you have to go in with gentle tongs, with gentle fingers, with gentle language. And one also has to refrain from what I've been suggesting all along, not to reify the religious. So often from the Western secular liberal tradition, we reify, rarefy, and simplify the religious so that we can order it, so that we can hold on to it and regulate it. The more complicated it is, the less stable it is, the less objective it is, and so the less we can actually do with it. So we have an imperative from our perspective as liberal constitutional human rights advocates. The imperative is to simplify and to reify, because religion is the other, religion is the object, religion needs to be simple, otherwise it's unstable. So as someone who does theology, who do I talk to? I talk to people who can avoid absolutists. Francis, your comment that the fatwa ends in death completely ignores centuries of scholarship on this issue, is reductive and reifies a very complicated instrument. And it's that kind of reification that makes it difficult to engage in conversations with human rights advocates because of the fundamentalisms that they bring to the table as well. And I certainly work with human rights advocates, but at the very least, what's important to me as someone who engages in the theology and the history of it is to recognize and accept the complexity without blanket statements. And I'm not sure that your comment on the fatwa ending in death does that for us.
Salman Rushdie would agree with me.
Go ahead. Last comment.
I take your point about the challenge posed from theologians that, you know, why is it, how is the human rights ideology different from a theological ideology? I think it's an important criticism. But at the same time, how you take that, understand that kind of challenge depends very much on how you define the word secular or secularism. If you look at the way in which Indian constitution has been conceptualized as secular, then there is a room for kind of, you know, discourse and dialogue with the theological and religious perspective, because in a sense, the way I understand the Indian conception of secularization is a form of universal ground upon which all perspectives of the diversity of religions, including non-believers, can be somehow accommodated, so that a particular standpoint of the Constitution does not kind of, you know, is not biased towards any specific religious perspective. So if you take that understanding of secularism, then, you know, you can look at the human rights concept as being that at that level of minimalistic kind of notion of bare universal kind of values which all major religious traditions would subscribe to. But in the end, for example, if you look at each of the major world religious traditions, when it comes to prescribing what it means to be an ethical person, there's a striking convergence. You know, I mean, of course, the interpretations may differ at different times. Some may say, oh, this kind of compassion should only be extended to your own kind, not to the outside. And, you know, there are all these differences, the kind of interpretations. But in the end, there is a possibility that there is, because especially if you look at the three monotheistic traditions, each of these traditions see themselves, and maybe Judaism is different, but Islam and mm-hmm. Christianity, at least I understand it, see themselves as universal salvation path. Now, if that is true, that it is a path open to everyone and anyone, then clearly there must be a theological mechanism built in it that would honor the humanity in each of these potential followers. So if we can get to that basic level, then there is nothing wrong with taking the minimalist notion of secularism and taking that as a kind of a shared common kind of an element. So I think it is very important that we do engage with, you know, kind of theologians, and you know, in the end, you know, world's great religious traditions have a much longer pedigree compared to the secular, you know, philosophy, although some might argue that, but I would argue that they have a much longer pedigree, so which in principle also implies that they are the custodians of thousands of years of human knowledge, experience, and insight. So to dismiss that completely, you know, rule it out of the part of the conversation is a disservice to the whole, you know, thousands of years of history of human experience. But at the same time, you know, I would be very cautious to really the charge that, you know, it's as ideological as any theological.
One quick announcement before I say thanks to everyone. The quick announcement is for young leaders and speakers at the conference. There is a dinner at 7 o'clock at the Omni, in case you haven't been informed. Now I'd like to extend some thanks. First, my apologies. The timing was ridiculous. We all recognize that it was ridiculous. This panel's topic could easily fill an entire day's conference, and we'd still have things to learn. I learned a great deal. I think we had six outstanding scholars and speakers who illuminated a very difficult topic. None of us expected to find closure here or a conclusive formula for squaring the circle, but I think all of us learned something, and we owe a deep debt of gratitude to our six speakers.